The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
As I said at the opening, Barry Ritholtz is one of the few strategists who saw the coming housing implosion and the derivatives mess far in advance. Practically nobody saw it. Barry was one of the few people that really saw it. He actually issued warnings about the market collapse in time to prevent his clients from getting caught up in the big recession, and for the readers of his post to seek safe harbor. As I told you earlier, he was named as one of the 15 most important economic journalists in the United States. He writes a column on investing for the Washington Post. He also contributes an occasional column to Barron's and Bloomberg. He's a regular guest on CNBC, Bloomberg, Fox, CNN, ABC, CBS, all the rest, and we've got him this morning on Straight Talk Money. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning. Apologize for being a little late. My train wasn't cooperating.
Well, that's perfectly fine. I needed to make a few comments on Europe anyway, which seems to be improving. In fact, do you have any thoughts on Europe? We were just talking about Europe, and things seems like things are doing a little bit better there. We got some new numbers out on Spain yesterday. Things aren't great, but it looks like at least they're beginning to turn the ship around.
Yeah, we have a substantial position in both Europe and emerging markets that we put on in the beginning of the year. We actually came into the year with an underweight in emerging markets and an overweight in the U.S., and we've since dropped the U.S. to equal weight as U.S. is no longer a cheap market. It's not crazy expensive, but it's not cheap. But we thought the general tenor about Europe and emerging markets in the beginning of the year was just, you know, overwrought with the usual hysteria, end of world, Europe is going to revert to feudal societies, etc. And we wanted to find an inexpensive and simple way to get exposure to that without having to send a team of analysts to Europe or Korea or Thailand to find emerging market companies. So either using ETFs or low-cost mutual funds, we have broad exposure to both emerging markets through a dividend strategy and Europe through a Vanguard fund.
Now, when you say emerging markets, there seems to be a differing now between emerging markets. For years, that meant the BRICS. But a lot of people are kind of pulling away from the BRICS and going to the smaller emerging markets like Thailand, for instance, and Colombia. Is that the area that you're looking at?
We're doing it less on a regional basis and more on a specific thesis for identifying solid companies with good growth and good cash flow. And the way we've managed to do that is through a dividend-driven emerging market ETF. And a lot of people tend to think, well, let's look at let's look at a particular country, or let's look at a particular type of industry, and I've found that that is really challenging unless you have a really big team on the ground, boots on the ground in a lot of different countries. So our thought process was, look, anybody can make up numbers about earnings. We've seen that in the United States, so we've seen that overseas. But you can't fake a dividend because that check has to go out every quarter.
That's right.
So we found an ETF. The one that we prefer, although there are a lot of other choices, is the iShares Emerging Markets Dividend. The symbol is DVYE. You'll probably not recognize the top holdings, of which no one company is more than 5%. Electropolo is one of the bigger holdings. It's a utility company. Anta Sports Products is another one. China Bills Finance. Shin Corporation, Ford Automotive, Sanani, and you end up with companies that either have a quasi-monopoly position like a utility or cable company, or you end up with not the typical U.S. too-big-to-fail banks or the European laden with sovereign debt banks, but these are mid-sized banks that, hey, you need banks in Turkey, and you need banks in Vietnam, and Korea, and Brazil, and Peru. And so they're stable, with a nice yield and nice dividend yield, and you end up with this being only moderately expensive. It's about 49 basis points, which is not terrible, and a decent dividend yield.
Yeah, that sounds like a very good investment. Listen, when we come back, we've got but less than a minute. I'd like to talk to you about kind of switching horses a little bit. You just came out with a blog about how much QE is driving the economy, and so many people feel like we have a artificial market because we have an artificial economy driven by quantitative easing. I'd love your take on that, and I want to talk to you about how you saw the last housing implosion, what you looked at to see that coming. So when we come back, folks, we've got Barry Ritholtz with us today, one of the top strategists on Wall Street. We'll be back to you in just a moment. You're listening to Straight Talk Money. We're bringing the Wall Street each and every day. Back in a moment. Stay with us.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
You know, as I tell you all the time, we welcome any recommendation for any guest you'd like us to have on the show. All you got to do is call Peggy at 855-624-4004. There is a guest that Peggy and I have been wanting to get on for a long time, and we finally got him, and he's with us today, Barry Ritholtz. And the reason we wanted Barry on is because he's one of the few strategists who saw the housing implosion coming years ago and the derivative mess far in advance. He issued those warnings, which saved him a lot of money, saved a lot of money for his clients and his readers. I remember reading it back then. I don't know of anybody else that actually – other people apparently knew about it, but nobody else said it as far as I'm concerned. He was the only one that I saw that did that. He's famous on Wall Street. He's considered one of the 15 most important economic journalists in the United States. As I said earlier, he writes a column for the Washington Post. He also contributes to Barron's and Bloomberg. He's been everywhere, and he just wrote a blog – and about how much QE is driving the economy. That's something we've talked about a lot on the show, Barry. And apparently in this blog, you kind of took issue. I guess there's somebody out there, if I understand correctly, that feels like 100% of the growth of the market is based upon QE.
That's exactly right. And look, there are lots and lots of folks who have been saying this, but for QE, you know, here's what would have happened. There's really two different issues. One is, what's the impact of QE on the overall economy? And then the next question is, what's the subsequent impact of quantitative easing on the stock market? The impact on the economy isn't that complicated to figure out. We've kept rates really low, so the bad news is you've anybody who's living on fixed income, and whether that's a foundation, a trust, a family, or just, you know, a handful of retired seniors who thought they were saving and were going to live off the proceeds just by cashing their regular quarterly interest rates, they've been punished and they don't get to spend as much as they would have otherwise. The flip side of that is anything that's credit-driven has boomed over the past 4 years. So we've seen housing. We could argue how artificial it is. Obviously, there's a high degree of artificiality in this. So housing has boomed because we've kept rates very cheap. You've seen record automotive sales after the U.S. auto fleet has become the oldest in its history. And some of that is because these cars are better made than they used to be. But a lot of it was people nervous post-Great Recession and not wanting to commit to, you know, cars are very typically the second biggest expenditure of a household. So that's what's been driving on the positive side. And I can't help but think that a lot of the banks that are still festooned with lots and lots of bad mortgages, had rates been allowed to rise normally, they would have seen a big uptick in foreclosures, maybe to the point that they find themselves back on the rope begging for yet another government bailout. So those are the three big things, the economy, three big impacts in the economy of QE. The thing that connects the stock market to the economy is obviously earnings. And while I can't figure out exactly how much QE is impacting earnings, I would be a fool not to admit it's having a significant amount. Think companies' borrowing costs are really, really cheap. Would you have seen a lot of these companies like Apple and IBM take out these giant bond offerings if it wasn't so absurdly cheap? So it's impacted the debt market. It's impacted companies' profitabilities. The cost of borrowing is so cheap. The cost of financing sales to your clients are cheap. It's definitely a significant factor in earnings. Now, when we get to the stock market, that's where things start to become a little more difficult. The head of chairman of investing strategy for J.P. Morgan is a gentleman named, last name is Michael Sembalest. And he created a chart that basically showed all of the stock market gains have taken place during periods of QE, and therefore, goes the leap of logic, this is what's driving stocks. The problem with that, and the blog post you're referring to, there are four major issues with that, and I'll keep it really simple. First, anything as big and complex and involved as a stock market almost never has just one single factor driving
right.
it. There's psychology, there's trend, there's monetary inputs. There are a lot of things. So I'm loath to say this caused that. The second thing is, go back to March 09, before QE was announced, before, you know, in the first quarter of 2009, you had a market that was down 50-something percent. Every metric that tracks sentiment was as deeply into the red as it gets. Look at how far the market was trading from its 200-day moving average. What percent of stocks were over their 200-day? There's like a dozen put-call ratio, advance decline, high low. You could look at just about any type of quantitative metric, which makes it more objective than some of the squishier things, and they were all as crazy oversold as they ever get. Now, it's not easy to step in and buy that. It's a little easier to cover shorts, but if you go back in history and look at how deep that those conditions, on average, they lead to about a 70% snapback. And that range has been as low as 41% and as high as just under 300%. And that, admittedly, 295% gain was in Finland. But if you just want to stick with the United States, coming from those conditions, you had 170% move in the 1930s. So it's hard to say when you have a market that was as ugly and oversold as that market was, that there isn't going to be a bounce back. In fact, there are always exceptions to every rule. I don't like to say always do this or never do that. But you could do a lot worse buying broad indexes that were cut in half, and we were more than cut in half. If you would have bought, by the way, Japan in 1989, when it was cut in half, you're still underwater 30 years later. But that's one of the few exceptions. Most of the time, when a stock market is slashed in half, it's not a bad time to buy. And if you want to look at specific sectors, banking, housing, technology, down 75 to 80% is often a good place to buy. This isn't a sure thing, but statistically, the odds are in your favor. And since we really don't know what the future holds, I always want to make the bet that puts the probabilities on the side of my client.
Right. Now, what do you think will happen with the taper? When they start tapering and they finally shut it off, what do you expect to see happen?
So that's a really interesting question. I want to put the taper into context because I don't think people really understand it. When Bear Stearns went down in March of 2008 and the Fed helped Jamie Dimon buy it, and the Fed guaranteed up to $29 billion worth of losses against Bear Stearns, that's about what the taper is. So if we actually get a taper, each month the Fed is going to reduce the total bond purchases by about what they promised to spend on Bear Stearns. So that gives it a little bit of context. Second, they're buying $80, $85 billion worth of bonds a month. If you take out $20 or $30 billion, you're still left with, you know, $50 to $60, but you're still left with two Bear Stearns worth of stimulus every month. So when people kind of were panicking about the taper, I don't think it's going to have that big of an impact on equities or on the economy. Where it will have a big impact, and here's where things get a little complicated, is it's going to allow interest rates to rise, to normalize. You saw it last over the summer, just the talk of it, they spiked.
Yeah. Barry, can you stay over with us for just one
sure.
more minute?
Absolutely.
I've got just a question to ask. We've got Barry Ritholtz with us today, folks. You can tell it's a great show, so stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Straight Talk Money, where we bring you the wisdom of Wall Street every day. Back in a minute.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
Well, we've had a great show today with Barry Ritholtz, one of the few strategists who saw the coming housing implosion. And he actually made the warnings. He issued the warnings about the market collapse and the recession in time for his clients and his readers to seek safe harbor. And considered one of the most 15 important economic journalists on Wall Street. That's pretty tall cotton. That's a rare crowd to be in. Barry, I'm sure that some of the folks out there are going to want to follow you in the future. How's the best way for them to do that?
So on Twitter, it's just at Ritholtz. That should be easy to remember. If you go to the blog, it's Ritholtz.com, R-I-T-H-O-L, T as in Tom, Z as in Zebra. And from there, all the other information, columns, asset management, all that fun stuff comes off of the blog. It's easy enough to find all that.
Yeah, but great blog. In fact, you had another one called How to Buy the Obama Market. So I think I want to kind of ask you that, and I want to kind of release you here and say, you know, can you tell us what you foresee going forward here? Are there any areas that you particularly like? Are there things you don't like? Is there something that keeps you up at night? I'd just like you to kind of talk to us about what you see going forward now.
Coffee keeps me up at night. I try not to have any after 5 in the afternoon.
I thought it might be Max and Jackson.
That's funny. You know, the interesting thing about, not to get zen on you, but the interesting thing about what to worry about is, and I know investors consistently have a hard time with this, is you have to focus on what's within your control and on what's out of your control. So I'm friendly with David Rosenberg, used to be Merrill Lynch's chief economist.
Right.
We were on a panel for an event in Chicago, and he went first and laid out a laundry list. The first question was, what are you worried about? And he laid out a laundry list of horrible things that he's worried about. And my answer was, listen, I can't stop it if it's going to rain. All I could do is watch the weather report and if necessary, bring an umbrella. So I have the sense that people stress about the Fed and they stress about what's going on in Congress. And, you know, Congress is the easy part. For most of the time, what they do doesn't matter. It's only when they do something really big or really stupid or both that things run into trouble. So When if Congress would have defaulted on the U.S. debt, that would have been a really huge mistake. When they make a giant tax cut like we saw in 01 and 03, 03-1 especially, that has a big impact on the economy. When there's a giant stimulus, that has a big impact on the stock market. Same with a big tax cut. So 90% of the time, maybe even 95% of the time, I don't worry about Congress because they're just doing their thing and never the twain shall meet. The thing that concerns me a little bit is we've never seen people play chicken with the credit rating of the United States. The U.S., you know, the dollar is the reserve currency. Charles de Gaulle called that an exorbitant privilege. So that was cause for concern because, hey, you know, there's certain things that we just don't joke about, and that's one of them. And it looked like this Congress was willing to do something with that. That's something I'm concerned about. The other thing that I really try and stay focused on, in addition to worrying about things that are within my control, is the natural tendency of our own emotions to lead us to do the exact opposite of what we're supposed to do in the market. So if you remember the news in the end of 2009 and 2010, it was horrible. It was all horrible. And if you would have followed the headlines, if you would have invested based on how your gut felt, you missed a fantastic rally. You know, we came up with a name for it in the office. We call it recession porn, which is the obsession with negative economic data after a recession ends. People are just so affected by what just took place. The recency effect drives their thinking as opposed to looking forward. It's one of those things that everybody has a tendency to celebrate or lament what just happened as opposed to looking forward and saying, where are the opportunities now? How do I take advantage of it? And it sounds a little bloodless and it sounds a little cold, but as an investor, you have to be objective. So you mentioned the Obama investing. When Obamacare passed in 2010, we went out and looked at what's the impact of this going to be. And once you put your politics aside, it was easy to say, well, there's almost 50 million people without insurance. Three-quarters of these folks are going to now have insurance. Who's that good for? Well, that's good for hospitals who are left holding the bag for anybody who visits the emergency room and doesn't pay for it. It's good for pharmaceuticals who are going to sell more of their products. It's good for any of the insurers who now have a guaranteed increase in their audience base. And so we looked for a way to express that. And there were a handful of companies that we thought would take advantage of it, as well as an ETF. So if you look at names like Johnson & Johnson and Merck, and if you look at the broad healthcare ETF, or if you want to be a little more aggressive, the biotech ETF, all of those were what showed up on our radar. And we said, I don't care if you hate Obamacare or if you love Obamacare, it doesn't matter. These entities are going to do really well. And then after the Supreme Court ruled on it in 2012, the big winners were the insurers and the hospitals. You know, there's a little-known law that was passed in 1986. It was passed by a Democratic Congress and signed into law by Ronald Reagan, a Republican, and it was aimed at stopping something called hospital dumping. So a patient would show up, they wouldn't have insurance, and they'd put them in a car and send them somewhere else. And people were, like, literally dying outside of emergency rooms. So it basically mandated that hospitals had to take care of all comers, anybody who showed up. And so when people look at why is the United States medical costs double most other industrial nations, that piece of legislation is a big part of it. You know, if you have a sniffle, you go to the doctor, you get, you know, antibiotics, it's $60. If that turns into full-blown pneumonia and you show up at the emergency room with 104 temperature, that's a $10,000 visit, and everybody else pays for that. When I say the hospital takes the loss, they spread it around and raise costs to everybody else. So they're a huge winner in this, the same with the insurers. Suddenly, they have a huge pool of people who they're capable of charging and actually getting paid, as opposed to showing up in the ER, getting expensive treatment, and then disappearing. So when we turn around and we look at this objectively, love it or hate it, it doesn't matter. There was a huge upside in those areas. And look at this year, healthcare is the top-performing sector in the S&P. So one of the things I constantly preach to people is, I don't care about your politics. I don't care about your personal likes and dislikes. Put all your biases aside. Try and be as objective as possible. Not easy to do. We all have inherent biases. We're wired for it. But if you have the ability to step aside and look at the world objectively, there's always money to be made.
All right, so you're not afraid of what's going on. You think we've got a little room to run?
You know, the U.S. it was fair value. You know, it was cheap in 2009. By 2010, 2011, it was pretty close to fair value. We've seen earnings plummet in 08, 09. They've since snapped back 140-something percent. So we're at a cyclical high in earnings. That's a little concerning, which is why we like Europe emerging markets. We're overweight there. We think there's more growth there the next couple of years than necessarily in the U.S.
Hey, Barry, we've got to run. Thank you so much for being with us today. We
My
really
pleasure.
Appreciate it.
And thanks for chasing me down during the transition.
Thank you. Thank you very much. All right, folks, I'll talk to you tomorrow. God bless. Have a great day.
You have been listening to a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.